When Esther is going into Achashverosh, she senses that the Shekhinah departs from her, and she's trying to figure out why. And one possibility she raises is Shemal Karat Shekarosiv Kelev. Now what happens is that Esther is davening to Hashem, asking that he return the Shekhinah to her that was Shor Sa'aleh before. And for first argument that she puts forward is that her relationship, her intimacy with Achashverosh was all Bionis. But she realizes that her tefillah was not yet accepted on high. The Shekhinah did not return. So she began thinking that because in her tefillah she called Achashverosh a Kelev. Now, we want to understand what's the chisaron here in calling Achashverosh a Kelev. So the Mefarshim suggests the following. There are two levels of tefillah. There's heartfelt tefillah, which a person pours out his soul when he thinks he needs a tremendous Yeshua. And then there's a low-key tefillah, when a person thinks that the situation is not so dire and it's not so dangerous. When she compares the enemy to a Kelev, and she wants through her tefillah to be saved from Haman, comparing Haman as it was to a Kelev is not the most powerful animal. And we know that dogs could be very dangerous, but as a general rule, Ein b'kocho l'hazik kol kach. Why? Because Haman is kafuf tachashverosh. And therefore her tefillah was a little bit on a low flame. But the truth is that the damage here and the jeopardy to Klal Yisrael is coming not only from the direction of Haman, but also from the direction of Achashverosh himself. And we discussed before, based on the Gemara on Daf Yudalit, that Achashverosh's hatred for the Jewish nation was even more intense than that of Haman. Now, Achashverosh is more comparable to the Aryeh, the lion, because he has the unlimited power to damage. No one could control him. He has total shilton. He can do Masha Ola Al Rucha, whatever he wants. So Esther now jacks up her tefillah to another level. And she includes in her tefillah not just Haman, the Kelev, but also Achashverosh, the Aryeh. She realizes that this is a danger from the Aryeh, and therefore she prays to save herself from Achashverosh the Aryeh. On the Pasuk Chatzia Malchus, Chazal say v'lo kol ha-malchus, v'lo dibra el b'dobra chotzeitz l'malchus. So the Marsha explains that the words of Achashverosh, when he says Ad Chatzia Malchus, are related to the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, that he would not agree under any circumstances to build the Beis HaMikdash. But it seems that the Gemara is taking the words Ad Chatzia Malchus out of the simple pshat. In other words, the pshutan shel dvarim would be, I'll give you half of the Malchus. And the answer is that for two reasons, it's impossible to take this pasuk literally, implying that Achashverosh was willing to part with half the Malchus. Number one is because in the law books of Paras of Madai, it's written that Ish kol Ish Sorer Bebeso, if he, Achashverosh, would part with half of the Malchus, and she would have control over half of the Nechasim, that would be a violation of kol Ish Sorer Bebeso. And secondly, we have a principle called Mashakana Kansa Isha Kana Baila. So what does it mean that he would give a half of the Malchus? Automatically we revert back to Achashverosh. And one of the poskim, the Shrus Yaakov, derives a halachic conclusion from this Marsha that even amongst Goyim, in the relationship between a husband and a wife, the rule of Kansa Isha Kana Baila applies. Now the Gemara gives a number of explanations as to why Esther's ploy, her approach, was through a seuda, in which she invites Achashverosh and Haman to partake in the banquet. But at the end of this whole list of explanations, And Rabbi Gamliel himself gives one explanation, as we'll soon see. Rabbi Gamliel makes a comment that we need the Modoy, Elazar Modoy. His answer, his explanation is critical. He says that she wanted to engender jealousy amongst the Sarim vis-a-vis Haman. So the Marsha explains that the Gemara was really asking two questions. Number one, why did she create a banquet? Why was that her approach? And secondly, why didn't she invite, you know, when you want to make a beautiful banquet, it's customary to get more and more offices from the king's court, and yet she only invited Haman. So all the explanation that were given until this point only explain why she chose this derech of seuda, of a banquet, in order to save the Jewish nation. But the second question, why she didn't invite other offices, was not answered. That's what Rabbi Elazar Modoy is coming to tell us, that she wanted to generate the jealousy of the Sarim. And now we have an answer to that second question. Rabbi Gamliel himself had explained that the reason why Haman was invited to that Seuda was because Esther understood that the Melech, the king, Achashverosh, was a hafchafchan, meaning he would change his mind. And Rabbi Gamliel admits now that he needs Rabbi Elazar Modoy's explanation, because his explanation is not sufficient. Because if Achashverosh could change his mind with the flip of a coin, then what would happen is the officers that surround Achashverosh would finally convince him that he should change his mind and go back to his original position to support Haman's program to annihilate the Jewish people. So what good is Esther gaining by getting Haman there and getting Achashverosh angry at Haman? He might change his mind as soon as the Sarim have an influence on Achashverosh, because he's so flippant, he's so mercurial. And therefore we need the answer of Rabbi Elazar, that Esther wanted to create jealousy amongst the Sarim, jealousy of Haman. And therefore, she doesn't have to be afraid that they would come in and try to recommend that Achashverosh change his mind once again and reconfirm or affirm his original position of Haman. Now, the Gemara has a long discussion, many different opinions, how many sons Haman has. But we only know of 10 that were killed. All the rest were Chazral Psochim, they were panhandlers, they were poor. Were there 10 of such poor sons of Haman in addition to the 10 that was killed? Were there 70 sons? Were there 188 sons? And a whole bunch of different opinions. But the question is, why is it that they only killed 10 out of all these, to almost 200 sons of Haman? And also, why were these other sons so poor that they had to knock on doors? Haman was a very rich man. And furthermore, we have another question here. Why did Haman have to tell his wife, Esrov Bonov? Did she not know how many children she had?
She's had 200 children. She
maybe she forgot their names.
Yeah, forgot their names.
Right. So the Ben Yoyada has a whole radical shot here. He wants to say that when Haman was boasting in front of his family, his beloveds, and how much success he achieved, he included in this the fact that he had a relationship with all the wives of the Sarim, and nobody knew about it. He had an adulterous relationship. The Sarim thought that their children, their wives' children, were theirs, but it really wasn't. It was Haman's children. And if he had such great hatzlacha to do such evil, Haman certainly, in his mind, was convinced that he would also succeed to perpetrate evil against Mordechai and the nation of Mordechai. When people heard about this, and the Sarim all of a sudden realized that their children are not theirs, they completely exiled these children. They sent them out of the house. And these children had no food to eat. Therefore, they were knocking on doors. But since we don't know exactly who they are and how to identify them, nobody knew which exactly were the children of Haman, therefore they couldn't kill them. And then we understand why the Chachmei Yisrael had so many different opinions about how many children Haman had, because in fact these children were not famous, they were not that well known. Now Gavriel, if you recall, is the Malach that saves Klal Yisrael, because he rewrote that which the Shamshi, that which the Sofer HaMelech erased. He was one of the children of Haman. He was the Shliach to save Klal Yisrael. And why is Gavriel singled out? Because Gavriel is actually the first Shliach in this whole episode of Purim to save Klal Yisrael. And that's true because when Vashti was summoned to show up at the banquet, it was Gavriel, as we learned earlier on Daf Yud Beis, he was the Malach who came down and attached a tail to her back, and she was therefore humiliated. She refused to show up. So Gavriel, the Gemara says on Yud Beis, Bo Gavriel v'asa lo zana. So he was the first in this whole series of events who came to set up a Hatzol for Klal Yisrael. Besides putting a tail on the back of Vashti, Gavriel was also, according to Pirkei Dermelaza, the very same Malach who caused Achashverosh to have a restless night. And he kept screaming into Achashverosh's half, when he was half asleep, into his ears, Kofui Tova, Shalem Tova Labaila. You know, you're an ingrate. You never paid back someone who did you such a great favor. And therefore, it makes sense that Gavriel, who at every step of the way was protecting Klal Yisrael, he would be the shliach, he would be the agent of Hashem, the Malach, to bring about this great Yeshua, that they would open up the Sefer Divrei HaYomim and it would say something about Haman, even though the enemies of the Jewish people had erased that text. Now the Gemara sets up a Kal Vachomer, and the Gemara says that if Gavriel down in this world was protecting the Jewish people to make sure that the original writings that were inscribed in the Sefer Zichronos would be protected, then how much more so those writings up in the document on high, which record the merits of Klal Yisrael and the rewards that are appropriate for Klal Yisrael, should be protected. Now, the Gemara uses the term Olam Hazeh. There's a Ksav Lamala and there's a Ksav Ba'olam Hazeh. The Ksav Lamala is the Ksav of Zchusam Shel Yisrael. Gavriel comes down from on high to protect Klal Yisrael in the Ksav of Olam Hazeh. Kal Vachomer, how much more so in the Ksav that's up in the Morom, up in the heavens, which is a zikaron for all the mitzvahs that Klal Yisrael implemented. So certainly he would watch them and protect them up in Shemayim, that they wouldn't be erased. So the Mefarshim here can't understand. What was the Hava meaning here? What's the big deal? Does anybody think, does it cross anyone's mind that if Klal Yisrael had zchuyot, they had merits, that the reward that was inscribed in the books up on in Shemayim would be erased? That we need some sort of protection? If Klal Yisrael did not sin, why would the zchuyot of Klal Yisrael be erased? What's the hava mean? But if, on the other hand, they do sin, the Gemara establishes a principle in the Masechta Sota, Daf Chaf Aleph, that avera mechava mitzvah, that even if a person does a mitzvah, it's not absolutely guaranteed that he'll get rewarded for that mitzvah, because the avera would cancel the mitzvah. So the Marsha writes,
that doesn't make sense, because the Talmud Devorah writes in a thing that you have a collection of a mitzvahs and a collection of averus, right? It's so if you have, let's say, 100 mitzvahs and 50 averus, right? It's not that one cancels the other. It's that, yeah, you have those averus, but you still have 100 mitzvahs, right? You have to pay for your averus, but you better to have 100 mitzvahs than that. I don't know, just...
So there are two opinions, actually, on this point, uh-huh. In Gemara Sota. One opinion says, aver mechav mitzvah. And that's what the Marsha points out here, that our sugya, uh-huh, reflects a different shita. That's Rabbi Shilo over there in Sota. Again, I didn't go through the sugya in Sota,
right, okay.
But he is cholek al haman diomer avera mechaba mitzvah. He holds avera ena mechaba mitzvah. Now, it could be that based on our sugya, the Torah Dvorah comes to the conclusion la'aloch that we accept that avera ena mechaba mitzvah. But the chiddush of our sugya is that why is avera not mechaba mitzvah? Not because the avera doesn't have the power to be mechaba mitzvah. Inherently it does. But Gavriel is going to guard our mitzvahs to make sure that the avera would not erase our mitzvah. We still have the sugya. Now, the last thing I wanted to share with you on the Agadah that we did in the last day or two is from the Chachat Yitzchak. Are you familiar with this sefer?
Mm-hmm.
So he says the following. He's curious as to know why is it that Mishloach Manos is so typical or so characteristic of Purim? What's the relationship between Mishloach Manos and Purim? So in order to answer this question, he goes back to a point that he made earlier about, in the name of the Gaon, about the comparison between Purim and Yom HaKippurim. The Gaon famously says that with regard to a regular Yontif, I'm not talking about Yom Kippur as an exception to the rule, the law is Chetzil Hashem v'Chetzil Lachem. We split the day in half. Yom Kippur is the exception to the rule. So Yom Kippur turns out to be a holiday which is completely devoid of Chetzil Lachem. Purim, on the other hand, is a holiday which is Kulo Lachem and has no Chetzil Hashem. Therefore, says the Gaon, these two sides of a coin, halves of a coin, complete one another. And the Yontif of Purim and Purim merge into one Yontif of 2 days, so that we get the Kula Lashem and the Kula Lachem, which is the equivalent of any other Yontif of Chetzil Hashem and Chetzil Lachem. That's the famous Chiddush of the Gaon. However, the Pachad Yitzchak wants to add another element to explain this complementary relationship between Yom HaKippurim and Yom Purim. He says the following. The most common denominator between the two holidays of Purim and Yom HaKippurim is the threat of destruction of Klal Yisrael. With regard to Yom HaKippurim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel, says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Heref mimeni ve'ash midem. That's the pasuk. God threatens to destroy the Jewish people. With regard to Purim, lahashmid, the same exact word, laragliavid. There's one fundamental difference then between the gzera of Heref mimeni v'ash midem and the gzera of Haman of lahashmid, etc. Yom HaKippurim, everything is up in heaven. There's nothing clear, revealed, down on earth. The gzera of Heref mimeni v'ash midem was revealed only to Moshe Rabbeinu. That was a private discussion between the Kaviyachal, between the Eivishter and Moshe Rabbeinu. But on Purim, the Gzera, and then subsequently the Yeshua, all took place b'makom nikar. It was all in the naked eye. You know, if anyone could see it, it was revealed. Because whatever happened between Achashverosh and Haman, and then later on Achashverosh and Mordechai, and so forth, this was all well known, well documented. So in that sense, when we talk about the Kedushas HaZman, the Zman of these two Moadim, of Yom HaPurim and Yom HaKippurim, whereas the Gzera of Ashmidem, of Yom HaKippurim, is all Lamala, therefore the Kedusha of Yom HaKippurim is Lamala. And what does that mean? He says the following. With regard to Yom HaKippurim, everything is spiritual. Let's say, for example, on Yom HaKippurim, we have to ask Mechila. What does that mean to ask Mechila? To ask Mechila means to touch on something in the inside, in the pneumius of a person. He calls it, the Pachad Yitzchak calls it, the Ritzui Upius is on inyani ruach. In other words, we're touching on the ruach, on the soul of a person. We're trying to touch his innards and therefore create amend the friendship between them. That's why on Yom HaKippur we ask for mechila. It's got to be divrei ritzui v'divrei pius. All this is poel on the ruach. It's all happening inside. It's all concealed. On Purim, on the other hand, where the Gzeirah was revealed, and also the Yeshua was clear, here the relationship of Bein Odom L'Chavero is going to be one of Mishloach Manos. It's going to be something that's tangible. It's take part of Yesuda and send it to someone else. It's revealed, and it's a different kind of Bein Odom L'Chavero. You remember that Esther, when Mordechai saves the Melech from Bigsam Viser, she tells it over in his name, and the Gemara says, we learned it yesterday, Kala Omer Dov Meshem Omro, Mevi Geula Liolo, Shenema Vatomer Esther LeMelech Meshem Mordechai. So Rav Hutna here in the Patek Yitzchak wants to understand, why is it that this principle, Ha Omer Dov Meshem Omro, was formulated here in the context of the Ness of Purim? There are many geulos, there are many redemptions. What's the direct relationship here between Kol Omer Dover B'Shem Omro and the story of Purim? So in order to explain this, he presents the Maral. The Maral Miprag wants to know, what is the relationship between Omer Dover B'Shem Omro, when you say something in the name of somebody, and that's going to be Mevi Geula Liolo. What's the quid pro quo relationship? So he says the following. The Maral says that Homer Dover, the word Dover, which means Dibur is really an expression of the Neshama, the inner soul of the Baal HaMaimer. When a person says something in the name of the Omro, he's really taking a branch and he's bringing it back to its roots. He says that Golos is all about severing the relationship between the branch and its roots. Because when a tree has branches and those branches want to expand and produce, there has to be a relationship between those branches and the roots. What is Golos? The Gemara tells us in Brachos Adaf Yud Zayin, Ritzoneinu Lasas Ritzonecha. You know, we're really rooted in a desire to fulfill the will of God. But what prevents us from doing so? Shibud Malchius Ma'akev. So what alienates our branches, so to speak, our ability to produce from our roots, which are totally dedicated to the will of God, is Malchius, Shibud Malchius. The subjugation of and pressures of the kingships is what cuts us off from our roots. And if that's what Golos is all about, then Geula means replacing and reconnecting those branches of life and spirituality to its shoresh, to its roots in the nefesh ha'adam. And therefore, Amiras Dover B'Shem Omro is parallel to Geula, because what is Amiras Dover B'Shem Omro? If a person's amira is an expression of their nefesh, of their inner soul, then if you bring it back to them, you're really replacing or reconnecting the branch to its roots. And that's a kind of a geula, when you reconnect the branch to the roots. And therefore he says the following. Why is this specifically related to Purim? Pachad Yitzchak, based on this maral, says that when a person is forced, he's compelled to do something, then that which he does really doesn't relate to his essence, to his inner personality. It's an external force. When the Jews accepted the Torah at Har Sinai, they did so under compulsion because of Kabbalah and Har Kigigis. And that Kabbalah, therefore, is not really a reflection of their inner soul. Now on Purim, Kibu v'Kiblu, they now completely invalidate the Modor Rabbalo Raisa, you know, the test, the the complaint against something that they accepted under compulsion, that even though the first Nasa Venishma was externally compelled and forced upon them, they were coerced, but now, at the time of Purim, they re-accepted Torah, Hadar Kibluah, and this Kabbalah now is a beetle of the Modar Rabbala Reis, because now the true will is to accept the Torah. This again is a great geula, because it means that now the anofim, the branches, are reconnecting back to its, to their roots. And that's what geula is all about. So the geula of Purim, in the most profound way, reflects the fact that Jewish people are going back to their roots. The roots meaning the essence of the Jewish soul is Ritzoneinu Lasas Ritzoneth, that we really want to fulfill your will. And now we accept the Torah, which is the will of God, embodied in the 613, willingly, out of our own inner desire. And it reflects our true nefesh. And that's what it means when it says, Vatomer Estel Lamelech B'Shem Mordechai, to take a person's Amira, which is a reflection of their neshama, and reconnect it back to them. Now the next piece I'm not gonna even make an attempt at explaining, because I don't understand it. It's a very short piece. He wants to know basically Venefachu Asha Yishtu Ayud Bisoneim. He says, what's this Venefachu? Venafochu. This is something that we put the emphasis on in Purim, Venafochu. And he goes on to explain the Gemara that we're about to learn now, that Haman prepared the tree to hang up Mordechai, and then at the end he himself was hung up on the tree. That's called Vasisim Lo Kasha Zomim Lasos, that we do to the Eidim Zomim what they want to what they don't want to perpetrate against the Nidon. And the Mefarshim compare it to a case of throwing a stone against a hard object, against a wall, and it rebounds. And that's called Venefachu, because you know that which you sent in one direction now comes back in the other direction. Up until that point I understood it, but after that I have no real clue what he has in mind. So now, Rabbosi, let's go back to the Gemara on Daf Tezayinam and Aleph, and we're up to Vayikach Haman Es Halavush. And this you'll find, I think it's about, how many lines down from the top? Let's see, about
seven
lines down from the top. Excellent. So I'm going to read the pasuk. It says, "Vayikach Haman es halavush v'sasus v'yalbeish es Mordechai." Now the Marsha says that the following, the Agadata, is all based on a Kabbalah, which means that there's no clear-cut indication in Megillus Esther that the entire episode that we're about to learn about took place. Many of the other agadatas are based on a diuk, you know, there's an extra word or a choice of one word instead of what we would have anticipated. Azal, Haman goes, Ashkeche, and he finds Mordechai. Where did he find Mordechai? I mean, there's nothing in the Megillah about this. The Yasvei Ravonen Kamei was teaching the Talmidim, who was sitting in front of him, Umachvi Lahu. Machvi, it means when I show you something with my fingers. Hilchos Kmitza, the laws of Kmitza. L'Rabbanon, he's teaching the rabbis the laws of Kmitza. Now we're going to see that the calendar date of this encounter between Haman and Mordechai is the 16th of Nisan, which is the day of the Havas HaOmer. Now again, the Mikdash wasn't standing, but there's a halacha called Lomdim Mi'inyano Shel Yom. It's otherwise known as Unishalma Parm Svasei, which means that if we learn the laws of the Beis HaMikdash, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers it as if we brought that karmon. And therefore, since the carbon of this day is the Omer, which had to be accompanied by a mincha, what's called the Minchas HaOmer, it was important for Haman, important for Mordechai, to be involved in the laws of the day, and therefore to teach the laws of Kmitza. Now, there's a long, long footnote here, interpreting the pasuk in Vayikra Beis, V'kamatz Misham Melo Kumtzo Misolto Mishmanto, etc., etc., How to do kmitza. Kmitza is very, very complicated because the Kohen digs his hands into the flour and with his three middle fingers he has to grab onto a certain shear, a certain minimum amount of the flour. And then he has to take his other two fingers, what we would call the thumb and the pinky, and he has to push away so that he flattens out the amount of the kometz that's underneath the three fingers. Because anything that's outside the three fingers is not allowed to be brought on the mizbeach. But at the same time, while he's doing this, he has to make sure that he still has a certain shear of kometz under his three fingers. And the Gemara tells us in Masechta Menachos that kmitza hoisa havoda me'avodos hakoshos, it was one of the most difficult and challenging avodos in the Beis Hamikdash. Bekoshi gadol, the Gemara declares, and the Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Maaseh, bekoshi gadol yamashve, he was able to flatten out the kometz under his three fingers, lo ye chaser v'lo ye yoser. It shouldn't be too much this way, too much that way. And Mordechai is demonstrating kmitza in front of the Talmidei Chachamim, in front of his disciples. Kema dechazi Mordechai. So Mordechai, again, if I could add a little drama of my own, probably out of the corner of his eye, he sees the apik lekable that Haman is coming towards him, v'suse, and he's holding on to a horse, mechad biyode, he's grabbing onto the reins of the horse. And at this point, Mordechai freaks out, if you can use that phrase. He's overwhelmed by fear, mirsas. He begins to think that now is this moment in which Haman is going to take him on the horse and put him to death. So therefore, Amalu l'Rabbanan, he encourages the rabbis, the Talmidim who are sitting in front of him, Hai Rishia, this Rasha, Lebiktal Nafshi, because he's coming to kill me, to rub me out. And therefore, Zilu Mekamei, get out of here, hide from him, Dilo Techavnu Begachlo, so that you should be burnt by his embers, by the charcoal, so to speak. Now, as we'll soon see, the Rabbanon stood by Mordechai. Even though Mordechai recommended that they flee, they didn't do so. And the Gemara continues to tell this story, which the Marsha says is all based on a Kabbalah that the Chachamim had. By he shaita, at that moment, nis'atef Mordechai v'kom le'litzloso. Mordechai had no option other than to pray to Hashem. And he wraps himself in a talis. Uh-huh. Now there are two interpretations as to why Mordechai, there may be more than two, but I'm going to mention two that I know of, why Mordechai wrapped himself up in a talis. One is because he wanted to focus on his tefillah. He knew it was a very critical moment in his life, and he wanted to, in a sense, overcome any distractions from the outside to have total focus on Bakoshas Rachamim. Others say that there's a pasuk in Tehillim, it says Tefillah Aniki Yatov, that there are different levels of tefillah, but when you get to the highest level of tefillah, which is total supplication, you wrap yourself around in a talus. And for example, slichos, you know, we have halacha that the shatz, and some have the minhag that even the members of the kahal will wrap themselves in a talus, because that's a tefillah of anius. Anius means an ani who's really begging for his life. Others say that the concept of ituf b'talus means whenever the Shekhinah is available, is accessible, is close, then you don't want to look into the Shekhinah, so you cover yourself with a talus. And apparently at this moment in time, Mordechai thought that the Shekhinah is there, and the Shekhinah is, so to speak, going to do one of two things. Either is going to permit Haman, give him a green light to take away Mordechai, or on the contrary, the Shekhinah is going to bring about a Yeshua Nahatzola. So he wraps himself in a talis. The Rambam, by the way, just as a footnote, when he talks about Kabbalah Shabbos, that's in the last chapter in Hilchos Shabbos, the Rambam says that the Hasidim Rishonim, the older generations, they used to go out to be Makabel Shabbos, go out of the town, and they would wrap themselves in a talus. So it's interesting because the Rambam says that Shabbos means that the Melech, again, the Kabbalists say it's a Malka, but the Rambam has the Melech is coming to greet us. And that's called Kabbalas HaMelech. And if the Melech is none other than the Melech Malka HaMelech, we have to wrap ourselves up in a talus. Suffice it to say that Mordechai, at this point, is involved in the most intense prayer that we can imagine. Levakesh Rachamim. Sheinotzel mehaman arosha. Asa Haman v'yosiv lei kamayim. Haman sits down in front of Mordechai. Now the Mefarshim asks, why does it say kamayim? Kamayim is in plural. And they derive the conclusion that the Talmidim was still there, despite the fact that Mordechai had encouraged them to flee. V'orich adisolik Mordechai tzilusei. And Haman waits patiently until Mordechai finishes his tefillah. Now, this is not out of respect to Haman. You know, the Nazis didn't wait until we finished our tefillah. But in this case, Haman needs Mordechai more than Mordechai needs Haman, because he has to show the king that he lived up to his misimah, to his responsibility. I have here a footnote in the name of the Sifsei Chachamim. He says Haman ratzel levalbil es Mordechai b'tfiloso. Not only was Haman waiting there, but he was hovering over Mordechai, hoping that he would distract Mordechai, so that Mordechai would not succeed in his prayer. And he says kasher odem roe es sono kenegdo, because he understood the psychology that if Mordechai would see his enemy standing right there, ein yochel lechaven, he would not have the ability to focus on his tefillah. And the Ben Ishchai adds that Haman lo rotzel ahafzik es Mordechai b'tefillah. So kevin she'evin she Mordechai mispal be'itzvon u'tefillahson einu mekubelos kol kach. So this is a deep, profound statement about what's called tefillah be'itzvon, which means that a prayer out of desperation when a person actually thinks that all is lost. The way I was always raised, that's the most profound kind of tefillah. But according to the Ben Ishchai, tefillah be'itzvon has a certain chisaron to it, because if you don't have total reliance on Hashem and simcha, then it's a little bit of a pagam in the tefillah. In any event, there's Haman hovering over Mordechai, Yosef Le Kamaya, Orech Le Adamach, the solid Mordechai Litzlusa. Amar Lehu. So Haman asks the following question as soon as Mordechai completes his field. But Mayas Kisu, what were you studying? Amar Le. And again, it's in plural. It sounds like the Talmidim responded to Haman's query. And they told him we were learning the laws of Kmitza. Bisman shebeis hamikdash kayom, if a person took upon himself a voluntary pledge to bring what's called a mincha, that's called a minchas nedava. And b'li neder tomorrow, remind me, I want to talk to you about why this was a discussion about minchas nedava. Because the pashtus was they were learning the sugya of the Minchas HaOmer. The Minchas HaOmer was a Minchas Chova, not a Minchas Nedava. But in any event, Maisi Malekum Tse the Sultan, he has to bring a full fistful of fine flour, and he's got to bring it on the Mizbeach Umiskaperle, and that's going to generate an atonement for his sins. But today, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, so we can't bring this Karbon. But if we study the laws of the Karbonos, then Hashem considers it as if we were makriv a karbon. That's a Gemara in Tainis, Unishalma Parm Svasenu. And the Gemara there says that Bizman Shekorin Bahen Lefonei Hashem declares that if they'll read, meaning study the laws of the Karbonos, Ma'alani Aleim, Kilu Hikrivum Lefonei, as if they brought it, Vani Mochalem Alkol Avanoseim. So this is the response of the Talmidim to Haman's question. Amar Lehu, so Haman says, Asa Malekum Tse Kimcha Didchu, are you telling me that this fistful of flour that you bring, the Jews, is going to protect you vidachi and completely neutralize the asara alfe kikre kaspa didi. I offered the king Achashverosh a massive amount of money, asara alfe kikre kaspa DD. Now please emphasize the word DD, because that's going to be the key word for the next sugya. And I bought from Achashverosh the rights to annihilate the Jewish people. So you're telling me that you're going to have a mechaper by learning the laws of Kmitza? And I sense, again, you could argue with me on this point, that Haman's response is cynical. You know, it's not that he's admitting the truth. Again, a lot of times Haman says the truth, but he means the opposite. Like, for example, yesterday we learned the Gemara that he says that he prepares a tree low. And Haman thinks he means low for Mordechai, but really low means for himself. He's preparing the tree for himself. So you always read Haman's words on two different levels. And it could be that on one level he's being cynical, but in fact he's touching on a basic truth here, that our Malei Kumtza is going to be more powerful and it's going to trump the Asara Alfe Kikre Kespa. So Mordechai picks up on this last word, DD, because Haman is boasting about the massive amount of wealth that he spent in order to bribe Achashverosh and get the rights to annihilate the Jewish people, Russia. He turns to him, Mordechai, and he says, "You're an evil person. Evet shekonen achasim." After all, we had a whole sugya, if you remember, 2 days ago, that Haman was an evet. He didn't have any possessions of his own. Eved lemi ulenechasim lemi. To whom are you an eved, and to whom do your possessions accrue? Who really owns these possessions? Because we have a principle that mashakana eved kana rava. And we mentioned before, I don't know, some of you came a little bit later, but the Chok Yaakov derives from this sugya the conclusion that the halacha of mashakana eved kana rava applies not just in Jewish Adon and Evan relationships, but even in non-Jewish relationships. And therefore, Haman, you don't own a thing. So when you tell me you gave this amount of money, really just absconded with that money. It's not yours. Amalei, at this point, Haman turns to Mordechai and says, let's get down to business. Tapas. Kum levosh hani money. Put on these clothes. These are the big day malchus. Urechov bahai susya. And get on the royal horse. Deboilach Malka, because this is what the king wants. He wants your yikar, your glory. Amalei, so Mordechai says, Lo yechilna. He says, I can't do such a thing. You're going to take me on the royal horse. I have to be presentable. You know, it's like, I don't know if you ever had this experience where your wife says to you, hey, buddy, it's about time you took a shave. Have you ever had that? Okay. So Mordechai says to Haman, Adi Aile Lebei Bonai Vi Eshkol Lemazye. Now, Bei Bonai is what's called in Hebrew a Beit HaMerchatz. In the Beit HaMerchatz, there were people who helped wash your body. They were professionals. They were called the Balonim, if you ever heard that word. That's a Gemara in Kira and Shabbos. And then there was Saparim, those who would make sure that you were well kept. They would cut your hair and shave your beard. Says Mordechai, Lav Orech Ara, it's not Derech Eretz, Lishtamushe B'mani D'malcha Hachi, that I should go and use the big day Malchus of Achashverosh when I'm in a state of Nivul, I'm kempt. Because keep in mind that this was the third day of the fasting, and basically the Jewish people looked like Shrek, if you know what I mean. That's where we had the whole ness of Esther when she came into Achashverosh, that the Malachim saw to it that they would beautify her. Shodra Esther Vasartinu Lekule Bei Bonai. So Esther closed up at that moment all the bathhouses, and she commanded all the Balonim and the Saparim to get lost. And they should go on strike, so to speak. Ulakule umne, and all these clay umnus, these you know, the utensils that you use, you know, like a dentist has his utensils, and a barber has his utensils. Put them away, lock them up. The aile iulabe bonai. And therefore, what's going to happen is that no one is going to be able to cut Mordechai's hair except for one person, and that's Haman. So Hichnis bi'atzmo es Mordechai lebeis ha-merchatz. Haman himself had no choice. He had to take, there was no one else to clean up Mordechai except for Haman. V'aschei. And he washes him. Now again, you have to be trained for this. So we're going to soon see that Haman was well trained for this. V'ozel v'aisi zuzah v'beisei. And now Haman goes home to get his scissors, because Haman was a barber in his younger years. Because shachol be'maziyeh, and he cuts the hair of Mordechai. Bahadi dekashakale, and as he's cutting Mordechai's hair in Gad, he was in a state of angst, of anguish. V'isnach, and he let out a krecht. So Mordechai turns to Haman and he asks him, "Amalei amaykom isnachas? Why are you kvetching?" Amalei, because Haman says gavra. He's talking about himself in third person, a person. Da'avichoshulei lamalka mikula ravravanose. I am the most significant of all the sarim in the king's court. And hashda, and now lishavye balone v'sapar. I become a balon and a sapar. Amalei, Russia. Mordechai says, "V'lav sapar shel kfar kartzim ha'yisa." I know your CV, and I know exactly what you did in your younger years in a place called Kfar Kartzim. You were the barber over there. So you're just going back to your original profession.
He's trying to make him feel good.
Really feel good, right? I know where you come from. You're a nobody. Tana, and the Brisa says, Haman sapar shel kfar kartzim ha'ya esrim ushtayim shana. This is, you know, on Purim, you know, we have all sorts of shtick. I can imagine in my mind, you know, Haman's barbershop. I never saw that in the celebration of Purim. Come in and get a free haircut in Haman's barbershop. Of course, 22 years he was a barber.
But one question: do we ever we hear the famous habit of Mordechai? Do we ever hear why he no longer is?
Yeah, because Mordechai was not able, once Haman was raised up to a level of the second in command, Mordechai could no longer press charges against Haman. You follow what I mean?
But I guess how did he become a second in command if he was an Eved?
The king could have released him from his avdut.
Well, I don't know if the king released him, but I think the king overlooked the fact that he was an Eved, or maybe the king wasn't aware of the fact that he was an Eved. Busted the Shakil no Lamazle. Now, after he finishes the haircut, Lav Shinu Lamone. Now he's ready to take the begad of the big day malchus and put him on Haman. Omalei. So Haman says, Sak v'rechav, get on the horse, and I will drive you on the horse. Omalei. Mordechai says, Lo yichilna. I don't have the energy. I'm so famished. I don't have any energy here to climb onto the horse. The kachishna, I've been weakened. Cheloi, my koach, has been weakened. Miyamei tainisa, as a result of the 3 days of fasting. Therefore, Haman had no choice. Gochen, he bends down. V'solik, and Mordechai jumps on his back, and he goes onto the horse. Kisolik, but as he's getting up from Haman's back, boitly, Mordechai gives a kick to Haman's rear, pardon the expression. Amalei, so Haman is a big lamdin, and he quotes a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk says, "Loksiv lechu." Doesn't it say in your holy books, "Binafolai vechal tisma"? You shouldn't be happy when your enemies are going down. Amalei, so Mordechai gives him a lamdish answer. Hani, immediately when does that pasuk apply to Israel? If your oivim are Jews, unfortunately, like a civil war between Yehuda and the other Shvatim, then you don't gloat over the destruction of your enemies. Now, it could be, I don't know, I the Marsha doesn't say this, but I think, again, don't quote me on this, but I think the Biditchu is a reference to Amalek. I'm not sure. Because he quotes the Pasuk Siv, V'ata albama semo tidroch. There's a Pasuk in Dvarim that we will completely overcome Amalek. And at the end of time, the pasuk says, that Amalek will be completely vanquished. Vayikulafanov, as Haman is, this is one of the most famous sagadatas in Shas, probably, about the daughter of Haman, right? You remember the story. Vayikulafanov, Haman is on the foghorn, you know, he's declaring, Kacha Yeosel Isha Shamel Kafesin Karkavi, Nakid Vyazel Bishvila de Bay Haman, as they're passing by the street of Haman, and Haman is carrying, you know, he's holding the reins. Chazise Barte de Kaima Igra. At that moment, his daughter was up. You know, we spoke about the 60 sons. We didn't tell her how many daughters Haman had. Anyway, so his daughter is up on the roof, and she sees what's going on over here. And she has no doubt in her mind that Haman, her father, is up on the horse, and it's Mordechai who's being forced to carry the horse. Savra Hai derachiv, the one who is on top of the horse, riding the horse, is Havua, is her father. Hai demaski kamein, the one who's carrying the horse underneath, leading the horse, is Mordechai. So what does she do? Shakla atzitza debei hakise. In those days, they used to defecate apparently in a certain atzitz, you know, a kind of a kli cheres. And she takes it, and it was full. Rashi says, and Shadise Aresha Davua, she pours it on the person that's on top of the horse. She pours it on the person who's leading the horse on the bottom, thinking that is Mordechai, when in fact it is Haman. Is Doli Ene. At that moment, when Haman gets hit by all these, okay, I'm not going to use the word, but at that point, Haman raises his eye. What is going on here? Who is the person who threw this on me? And at that point, she realizes, when Haman raises his face, his eyes, that she had thrown on her father. Naflami igrali ara. She lost it. Again, some say she did this deliberately. She threw herself off the roof. Umesa. And in this case, the Marashah says there is a raya from the pasuk that this actually happened. All the other details in this story are based on Kabbalah, that Chazal had a tradition. But the fact that she died is going to be based on a pasuk, as we'll soon see, V'hainu d'siv, and that's the pasuk by Yoshev Mordechai al-Shara Melech. Okay, so Mordechai goes back after this whole episode to the Shara Melech. Again, that's going to be an interesting question in itself, because this whole thing started when Mordechai was teaching his Talmidim, he was not located in the Shara Melech, and that's where the whole entourage began. So what does it mean by Yashav? Omer Rav Sheshes Sheshav L'Sako L'Taniso. You know, you would think that after Mordechai had this great Gedula, you know, he's not in the mood to go back into Sako Taniso mode, but he does so, because he realizes that the Yeshua is not yet there, that Haman's Gzeira is still very much imposing. But then the pasuk says, "V'haman nidchafel beso avel v'chafui rosh." So the Gemara wants to know, what does the word avel mean? You know, the many words that you could use to describe the situation of Haman at that moment, but avel means he's in a state of avelus. Why is he in a state of avelus? Says the Gemara, "Avel al bito." He was a mourner because his daughter died. V'chafui rosh al she'irulo, and the chafui rosh is a reference to the humiliation that he suffered at that moment in time. Then the pasuk says, "Vayisaper Haman lezeresh ishto lechol avav vayomer lo chachamav v'zeresh ishto." Interesting. At the beginning of the pasuk, we talk about o'avav, which means the close friends, the beloved friends of Haman, and then it says chachamav, indicating that there were scholars over here. So the Gemara asks, "Kari le o'avav, kari le chachamav?" How can you use both terms? It doesn't make sense. Either it was Ovav or Chachamav. Omer Rabbi Yochanan kol Omer Dvar Chachma Afilu Miuma Beumot Sa'olam Nikra Chacham. That sometimes a member of the nations of the world can come up with a Dvar Chachma. Now here the Marsha claims that the phrase Dvar Chachma is identical with Chachmas HaTorah. So this is pretty amazing. You know, when we speak about a guy who's coming up with an insight into the Torah itself, and what was the Chachma? So let's listen to the words of the Chachama. Vayomer lo Chachamav, im mizera Yehudim Mordechai lo tucha lo ki nafol tipol lefanav. We'll soon see the double language in nafol tipol. But right now, what is the thrust of the argument, the logic here? Mordechai comes from Zera Yehudim. Now, the Chazal understood that Zera Yehudim means that he came from a specific lineage. In other words, Haman, I shouldn't say Haman, I should say the Chachamim of Haman are now focusing on the genealogy of Mordechai. And the genealogy of Mordechai is going to play a major role. Lo tuchal lo, you will not be able to defeat him. Amrulei, this is what they were telling Haman. If Mordechai doesn't have any great genealogy, yachlesle, you can defeat him. But if he comes from these shvatim, then lo yachlesle. And this is all based on psukim, which the Chachmei Umas Olam understood. And I'm always fascinated by the fact that throughout all these agadotas, you know, the worst people are quoting scriptures. But I don't know. You can either take it literally, or maybe it's more symbolic. But it does say the word does say chachamav, and the whole quote here seems to be a literal quote of the chachamav. Now the chachamav here in this encounter are not Jewish chachamim, because this is Haman who's getting together with Zeresh Ishto, with Oavov and the chachamim, and it seems like they knew scriptures. It's like, for example, if you go back, I wouldn't say contemporary, but not long ago, you know, you talk about the Puritans who came to America, and you talk about you know, the Dutch and the Christians at that point, they knew the Old Testament, you know, Today, I don't know if your average Christian knows much about the Old Testament. But back in the day, they could quote scriptures. And they understood from the psukim that there are two shvatim that have a very powerful descent, that their descendants are very powerful. And those are Yehuda and Binyamin. We'll soon see about Ephraim and Menashe. But in the case of Mordechai happens to come from both Shevet Yehuda and Shevet Binyamin. Do you remember this discussion
right.
we had?
Yeah, we had it before.
Correct. That Mordechai is called Ish Yemini, which means that his father was from Shevet Binyamin. He's also called Mordechai HaYehudi from Shevet Yehuda, because his mother came from Shevet Yehuda. Now, how do we know that the descendants of these families of these shvatim are very powerful? Yehuda, the Chesiv Apostle Gibracious, in the Brach that Yaakov bestows upon you, that says, Yodecha Biorif Aivecha, which means that Yehuda could defeat his enemies. Enoch, and the other three Shvatim, Binyamin, Ephraim, and Menashe, the Chesiv Apostle in Tehillim, Lifnei Ephraim, Ubinyamin, and Menashe, Orera Es Gvura Secha, Kadosh Baruch Hu is Maorer, the Gvura. He gives a certain power and a certain, what we call, Siyata Dishmaya, to allow these shvatim and their descendants to defeat their enemies. Ki nafalti pol afon of why the double language darish Rabbi Yehuda bar Eloi, shtei nefilos halol lama, why two nefilos, amru lo, those who were in the entourage of Haman, the close, beloved friends of Hadar, said the following, umazu, there are two different ways in which the Tanakh describes the Jewish people. On the one hand, Mishulali Afar, they're compared to the dust of the earth, the lowest of the low. As the Pasuk says, Vesamti Esaracha Kafara Oretz. This is what Hashem says to Avraham Avinu. But on the other hand, Mishulali Kochavim, they reach the highest heights. Because Hashem says to Avraham Avinu, Abed Nashamay Mesfar Kochavim Koye Azaracha. And how do we reconcile this apparent contradiction? Are the Jews the lowest of the low, the highest of the high? Shem Yordim, when they go down, Yordim ad Afar. They reach the lowest level. The Gemara is going to tell us in Gittin about the daughter of Nakdimon Ben Gurion. He was the richest Jew at that time, in the time of the Churban, and she was collecting grains from the feces of the camels. You remember that? This is called Yordim ad Afar. They go down to the lowest of the low. I mean, you don't have to think of ancient history. I mean, just think about the Holocaust, right? Ukshem Olim, but when they're on their way up, Olim Ad Ha Lakochavim, they go all the way up to the stars in the heavens, and they have complete protection. There's no Ummah, there's no nation who could be Sholeid, who could subjugate them. Let me just end one sentence. In the Mefarshim say the following, that what is the point here of Nafolti Pol? It means the following, that the Jewish nation are like, if I can give the muscle, electrocardiograph machine. In other words, when they go down, they go all the way down, but immediately they rise up. So therefore, the first nefilah here, ki nafal, means that now the Jewish people are like afar. They go all the way down. And yet, what's going to happen now is when they reach the lowest point, then the curve moves upwards, and this is a siman, the nefilah of Yisrael is a siman, that now the oivim are going to go down, and they, the people of Israel, go up all the way up to the kochavim, and instead of you, Haman, being the Mishnah Lamelech, Mordechai is going to take over and be the Mishnah Lamelech. Yeah,
sorry. Oh, I was just going to say, because I always had trouble with why the first time he was taught with me, you know, he was with his wife and his friends, you know, the day before the first Mishnah, they were saying go, you know, why didn't they see that he was going to lose anyway if he was against the Jews? But I guess this explains it. They thought the Jews were descending at the time as
right. To ascending. That's the question, were they on the way down or on the way up?
That's the.
So I just want to make two points. That first of all, from a religious Zionist perspective, that's what happens after the Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel.
Right.
And from a perspective of prices, my father, may he rest in peace, used to always say about Shmura Matzah, that he used to say the following, that there was a point in his life where it was very hard to get Shmura Matzah back in Europe, in Lithuania, he said. So then the Jews were very down. And now we'd say that we were on our way up and the prices of Shmur Matz are also on the way up. He used to complain about
Or maybe the price was the same. You know, like if you can't get something, the price goes up.
All right, gentlemen, it's good to have you. Have you all here. We had full attendance today. That's exciting. Have a great day.
Yeah, that's the whole story. When Am Yisrael is at the bottom, there's no place, you can't go any further. Once you've hit rock bottom, you've hit rock bottom.
The hard part is knowing when you've hit rock bottom.
That's right. We don't know how far we're going to end up.
Exactly.
But we know for sure. When once we hit that rock bottom, it's up again. It's just up from that.
It could only go up.
You can only go up.
The arrow could only